Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the first full week of December. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today I will be talking with Curtis Deutsch, Professor of Chemical Oceanography at the University of Washington. Dr. Deutsch's research and teaching interests are aimed at understanding the interactions between climate and ecosystems, especially the relationships between global patterns of climate variability, biodiversity, and physiological adaptation to environmental change. Today, we'll be focusing on what's happening to the oxygen levels in the ocean and why it's important. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. A quick hint, this critter is common in weedy or shrubby lowlands and city edges during the winters along the Pacific coast. Now, with local observation and bits of news and with the help of Charlie Flashman, our wonderful sound engineer. Charlie, what are people seeing?
As reported on the Admiralty Audubon Sightings webpage, Chaz and Deborah Dowd saw ruddy ducks, northern shovelers, ringneck duck, coots, and at least seven pairs of great blue herons, Eurasian and American widgeon, pintails, trumpeter swans, mallards, canvasbacks, buffleheads, and green-winged teal on the pond out near the Discovery Bay golf course.
On a recent hike along the Dosey Wallops, Wendy Feltham had a field day observing mushrooms thriving in our wet weather. Bear with me here. Smoky-gilled Hyphaloma, Clytocybe dilatata, Coniophora putiana, Tremella mensaterica, otherwise known as witch's butter. Scientific names because they don't have common names for the most part. These are just a few of our local mushroom species to be seen in the moist woods. Grab a field guide and go out to see what you can find.
Last Sunday night under clear skies, Port Townsenders were treated to the largest supermoon of the year. A supermoon appears especially close, full, and bright. A supermoon occurs when a full moon coincides with the moon's closest approach to Earth in its elliptical orbit. If you miss seeing the supermoon, pay attention in January 2018. January will have two supermoons, one on January 2nd and another just a few weeks later on January 31st. NASA has tokened this the supermoon trilogy, with three supermoons occurring in just a two-month time span.
And the wonder of this month's supermoon is it occurred on a very clear night. Lastly, I want to share an article that I recently read in the New York Times Science News about scallop eyes. If you've ever seen scallop eyes, you will know what I'm talking about. If not, visit the Port Townsend Marine Science Center to observe the two rows of eyes fringing the opening of scallop shells. Each eye looks like a small blue bead, and together they form a lovely blue necklace of hundreds of eyes. Human eyes are comparable to a camera, a lens with a light registering retina at the back of the eyeball. Scientists have known for some time that a scallop eye is more like the reflector telescope, which uses a mirror and was first invented by Isaac Newton in the late 1600s. Scientists in Israel recently used a powerful new tool known as a cryo-electron microscope to look at scallop eyes. It seems that the best analogy for a scallop eye is more like the highly advanced Hubble telescope, a multi-layer mirror constructed of multitudes of square crystalline tiles reflect light into two, not just one, retinas. This recent study shows that scallops have evolved a mastery over forming crystals, guiding them into shapes that researchers didn't think possible. Actually, scientists have no idea why a scallop needs what is essentially Star Wars vision technology. Let's go on to our conversation with Dr. Deutsch. Well, now let me introduce Dr. Curtis Deutsch, Professor of Chemical Oceanography at the University of Washington. I'm going to quote his website. His research is aimed at understanding the interactions between climate and ecosystems. Dr. Deutsch's work contributes to the better understanding of how climate and climate change influence patterns of marine habitats and biodiversity. And Dr. Deutsch will be giving a lecture this Sunday as part of the Port Townsend Marine Science Center lecture series. Well, a little more on that later. But today we will focus primarily on oxygen in the marine environment. It is easy, but incorrect, to assume that oxygen must be rather evenly distributed throughout the ocean waters, given the mixing that goes on due to ocean currents and winds. It's also easy, but also incorrect, to assume that, except in very special situations, having enough oxygen in marine waters is no big deal. So, welcome, Curtis, to Nature Now on KPTZ.
Thank you, Nan. It's great to be here.
And I'm also looking forward to your talk on Sunday, and we'll talk more about that later. So let's first start with some basics. Oxygen in the ocean waters. How does it vary across latitudes, longitudes, with depth, special areas? I mean, it is kind of easy.
What are the big patterns?
Yeah, it's easy not to think much about that, but what are the patterns?
Well, I think maybe the most useful starting point is to think about how our planet got oxygen in the first place, because it actually leads to a better understanding of the spatial patterns in the end. The first thing people will be familiar with is that oxygen is not especially stable in the atmosphere, and anyone who's lit a fire can attest to the fact that oxygen can go away rather dramatically under the right conditions. So how does it remain in the atmosphere? Well, it gets there by photosynthesis. So plants taking water and carbon dioxide in the presence of sunlight and making oxygen and organic matter. So ultimately, all the oxygen that gets into the ocean came from photosynthesis there. Of course, over the eons of Earth's history, a lot of that oxygen escaped into the atmosphere, and the atmospheric oxygen that we breathe is long-term accumulation of that photosynthesis.
So it was initially through aquatic phytoplankton and plants, and then
later terrestrial. Land plants came along later, and they contributed some, but largely it's marine photosynthesis by phytoplankton that created the atmosphere that we're breathing right now. Now, the peculiar thing is that the atmosphere is rich in oxygen, but the ocean that generated most of it is very depauperate in oxygen relative to the atmosphere. So there's like about 60 times as much oxygen in the atmosphere as there is in the ocean. The reason for that is relatively simple. It's just that oxygen is not especially soluble in water. So the ocean and the atmosphere kind of come into a sharing of the oxygen that's very unequal, simply because water is not that good at dissolving a gas like oxygen. And so that just creates a situation where the ocean can become depleted in oxygen. Now, we're starting to get glimpses of a pattern already right here, because what I said already is that photosynthesis is the ultimate producer of oxygen. But if you've ever seen documentaries about the ocean, you realize that most of the ocean is dark.
Right, and photosynthesis is only going to occur in the upper layers.
And exactly right, because light is a key ingredient. The ocean is a couple miles deep, but as soon as you're maybe a couple hundred feet deep, there's really not enough light to do much photosynthesis. So the vast majority of the ocean depths are dark, and that cuts off the ultimate supply of oxygen to the whole world, right? There's no photosynthesis down there. So how does the deep ocean get its oxygen? It has to have oxygen, right? Because there's animals down there.
Right.
And they have to breathe the oxygen that's dissolved in water. How does it get there? Well, then we come to the physics of the ocean, as you mentioned, ocean currents and mixing. So it requires that the ocean be constantly turning around, turning over, and circulating in order to maintain the oxygen of the deep ocean in the absence of any photosynthesis. So the very first thing we see when we look at a pattern of oxygen in the ocean is that it decreases as we move from the top of the ocean where there is photosynthesis to the deep ocean where there isn't. Now, the reason why the stirring up of the ocean, the physical currents, don't keep the deep ocean well oxygenated is that at the same time that they're carrying oxygen into the deep ocean, there are bacteria down there that are doing the opposite of photosynthesis, namely respiration. So they're taking all this organic matter that falls from the sunlit surface ocean. They're decomposing it in much the same way that you do when you light a fire, except not so dramatically,
right.
releasing the energy and the organic matter and consuming the oxygen. So there's the first most important thing about oxygen in the ocean is that it decreases as you move from the top of the ocean down to the bottom. Now, if you want to know the next main aspect of the pattern, you have to think about exactly how those ocean waters circulate. To create a very simple picture of that, just imagine that the ocean is like a bunch of different layers of water, each with its own weight per unit of volume or density.
Mm-hmm.
And as you might expect, the least dense waters sort of sit on top. They're relatively buoyant, and the densest waters fall to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ocean waters get increasingly dense with depth, and they also get older and older. That is that they're circulating less and less quickly. It turns out that because the deep waters are cold, they had to come from some place at the surface of the ocean that was also cold. There's no refrigerators in the deep ocean to cool things down. They're cold because they came from a cold place at the top of the ocean, which means that they came from, let's call it mid-latitudes or high
mm-hmm.
latitudes, the colder parts of the Earth's surface. And that means that if you were to measure oxygen, let's say, right at the equator going from the top to the bottom, as you go down, you're seeing water that came from further away on the surface of the Earth toward the poles,
mm-hmm.
the North Pole or the South Pole. And that means it's been away from the surface ocean for a really long time, because remember, the density layers
mm-hmm.
are stacked on top of one another. And that means that water in the deeper, lower latitude ocean has had the greatest time to lose its oxygen by the bacteria constantly using it up. So if you want to find the place that has the least oxygen in the whole world, you'd go to the tropical oceans, but deeper down, below the surface, where you're away from photosynthesis. That combination, being deep, where we know oxygen is going to be consumed by bacteria, and far from the places that send water into the deep ocean, i.e. far away from the cold parts of the Earth, i.e. the tropics, that's where you're going to find the most oxygen-depleted water. And it turns out that we can find water in the ocean that's below the surface in the tropics that is completely devoid of oxygen. It's what we call an anoxic zone, sort of reminiscent of the early part of Earth's history before plants even came along and started pumping oxygen into the ocean.
You talked about age. Give me an idea of how long would it have been, generally, since that water would have been at a surface somewhere?
Yeah, so if you're in kind of the mid-depths of the ocean, you can find waters that are, we would put an age of something like a century.
Wow, okay.
Decades to a century,
mm-hmm.
maybe a couple centuries.
Okay.
But not years and not millennia.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the very deepest ocean, you can find waters that have been away from the atmosphere for over 1,000 years. So then we're kind of a millennial
wow.
scale
mm-hmm.
age. And it turns out, this is a slight peculiarity, but the deepest waters have actually more oxygen than those middle depth waters. And that's just because even though they're older, the rate of bacteria consuming oxygen is much, much lower. The deepest waters are able to retain more oxygen, and the most anoxic waters are actually sitting almost right below the surface of the ocean.
Most of us here on the West Coast are familiar with upwelling. Is that one of the forces then that brings that deeper water up to the surface?
Yeah.
What about the oxygen in the upwelling zones?
So that's a really key thing, is that, as I mentioned, because the oxygen is made in the surface ocean and it's circulated down into the deep ocean, if you're in a place where the water is moving down, you can expect to find relatively well oxygenated water. What you're talking about is exactly the opposite situation, where you don't have water downwelling or moving down, you have water being lifted up to the surface from the deep ocean. And that's going to be the most oxygen depleted water around, because it's right at the end of its circuit through the deep ocean. It's right about to come back to the surface. It hasn't seen the atmosphere for a long time. So it's the upwelled water, water that's upwelling, for example, right off of our coast, tends to be some of the lowest oxygen water that you can find.
So talk to me a bit about the impact that has on marine animals that need oxygen, and how does that work?
All animals need oxygen. We couldn't evolve until there was enough oxygen in the atmosphere to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened, of course, first in the ocean as well. Since then, of course, some land animals evolved back into marine animals
right.
that are mammals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to think about whales and dolphins and other marine mammals now because they have a different way of getting oxygen, right? They just come up to the surface and they breathe air just like we do. But for everything else, what I'll say is true, they have to have ways of extracting the dissolved oxygen molecules out of seawater through something like a gill, if they're a fish, or some specialized membrane that's good at taking oxygen out of seawater and putting it into the tissues. And it turns out that because oxygen is relatively scarce in the ocean compared to the atmosphere, that ability to extract oxygen is an important thing for animals to be able to do. It's a much more difficult task, if you like, for a marine water breather than it is for a land air breather. And it's especially difficult, as you would imagine, in places where the oxygen is relatively low. It's virtually impossible in the places where we find anoxic or zero oxygen water. And those places, we sometimes call them dead zones because there's really not much there that can live except for some specialized microbes, bacteria.
They can use other things,
That can use other things, indeed.
It's another subject, but anyway.
Side story. But animals have evolved over the last half billion years, really, to be able to tolerate a pretty wide range of oxygens. Some of them really don't tolerate oxygen very much below the highest levels, and some of them can tolerate low oxygen almost all the way down to the anoxic levels. They're really good at managing their metabolism in waters that are very low in oxygen. And they can do that in a variety of ways. They can either be really good at extracting oxygen from seawater, or they can learn how to basically hold their breath, slow down their metabolism to temporarily reside in low oxygen water. But across most of the marine animal biota, we can see a wide range of oxygen tolerances that seem to be somewhat well matched to the places that they live. Otherwise, they wouldn't live there.
So it is sort of a cause and effect thing. One of the factors in determining where they can live.
That's right. People have known for a long time that if you have extreme cases, either maybe they're permanent situations like an anoxic zone where there's really not much animal life, that oxygen had to be a really important thing restricting that patch of ocean from being inhabited by marine animals. And we've also known for a long time that even if it isn't permanent, a sudden and dramatic drop in oxygen, as you might find in, say, the Gulf of Mexico every year, or more recently, episodically off the west coast of the United States, most dramatically off of the Oregon coast, episodic reductions of oxygen that are rapid can also cause mass mortality events, die-offs of marine ecosystems. Those are all dramatic cases, right? They're sort of extreme situations. I think what's only becoming clear now is that even in the sort of mean, like the average condition of the ocean, a lot of animals do seem to have their habitats restricted by the availability of oxygen. Their habitat will extend into those waters just to the point where they've got enough oxygen to maintain their need for energy, and then they can't go any further. And I think it's just really becoming clear now that oxygen is playing a role in defining the boundaries of where individual species live and where they don't live.
So interesting that just as we're learning about how oxygen is remarkably different in different parts of the ocean and it affects where marine animals can live, we also have changes in our climate occurring. Tell us how that is going to affect the oxygen, but more ultimately how it's going to affect marine animals and the habitats where they're able to live.
There's really two ways that the warming up of the ocean causes oxygen in the ocean to go down over time. And the first way is the simplest, and that is that as the water gets warmer, it holds less gases. And that's true for oxygen and other gases as well. So warmer water will be less oxygenated to start with. But now also remember that the way that the deep ocean gets its oxygen is by waters at the surface circulating downward. And it turns out the warmer you make that surface water, the less dense it gets, the more buoyant it is. And it's harder and harder to circulate that water down to the deep layers where that oxygen is really needed by the marine life. So you're going to see
declines. So throughout the ocean,
That's right, from these two effects acting together for the most part. Now, if you think about the perspective of a marine animal that needs oxygen to maintain the energy for metabolism, it's got less oxygen coming in, right? Because the water is starting at the surface with less oxygen and it's moving more slowly down to the deeper layers. Here's one additional effect, and it's almost universal across marine animal life, that the warmer the water is, the faster their rate of
metabolism is,
which
yes.
means that they actually
need more. Yeah,
exactly. So they not only get less oxygen coming from the circulation of the warmer water, they are sitting in warmer water where they actually need more oxygen than they needed before. So it's sort of a double whammy for marine life. Your demand for oxygen goes up and your supply goes down, and you don't need much life experience to recognize that that's not necessarily a happy situation. To need more and have less can cause severe restrictions on your ability to live in a given patch of water.
Some animals could relocate, but others can't.
Exactly. This is true. It gets very complex when you start to think about how migration of animal populations might offset this squeeze between more demand and less supply, partly because, as you said, some animals can migrate relatively easily. Think about fish. Others, sessile organisms that just sit planted on the bottom of the seafloor, can move and migrate less easily. And so there's going to be probably a whole lot of variation in how different animal species and populations experience a loss of viable habitat.
And this sounds like a great unknown that we're heading into. Curtis, this is fascinating to me, and we have only barely scratched the surface. If we think about other changes and other factors, currents, winds, nitrogen, what anaerobic critters do, it's almost mind-boggling. But we're going to have to stop for this radio show and remind folks that this coming Sunday, Curtis Deutsch will be at the Commons in Fort Worden giving a lecture for the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. And the lecture's entitled, Curtis, give me the title.
Oh, I think it's Short of Breath.
Short of Breath,
marine life
yes.
in a warming ocean.
Something like that. So that people will not only learn more, but you can ask questions. So that's 3:00, the Commons at Fort Worden. Thanks so much, Curtis. It's opened my mind to a lot of really different things to think about.
Great. Well, I hope your listeners enjoy it.
Let's now, though, listen to that mystery sound again. That was the plaintive song of the golden-crowned sparrow. Bird watchers sometimes characterize this song with the words, "Oh, dear me," or "I'm so tired." Gold miners in the Yukon at the turn of the 20th century woefully referred to the golden-crowned sparrow as the "no gold here" bird because its song resembled that depressing phrase. The large, handsome golden-crowned sparrow feeds on seeds and insects on the ground and in low vegetation. Look and listen for the golden-crowned sparrow in the woods around town. Yes, they have arrived. And though it's familiar to many during the winter, golden-crowned sparrows vanish for the summer into tundra and shrublands from British Columbia to Alaska, where little is known of their breeding habitats. I want to thank Cornell Ornithology Labs and their All About Birds website and the Macaulay Library of Sounds for these recordings. Looking forward to upcoming events, again with the help of Charlie Flashman. Charlie.
Admiralty Audubon is hosting a field trip on Saturday, December 9th to Fort Flagler, looking for dunlins and plovers. On Sunday, December 10th, join folks for a work party to plant shore pine near Highway 20 and to remove invasive weeds and clean up trash. Lastly, sign up now for the Christmas Bird Count to be held on December 16th. It is open to all. Check out the Admiralty Audubon website for details on these events.
And the Squim Dungeness Christmas Bird Count, which is organized by the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society, will be Saturday, December 9. Also, in addition to offering bird walks every Wednesday morning, the Olympic Peninsula Audubon is hosting a class on owls at their Dungeness River Audubon Center on Saturday, December the 16th.
Join the folks with the local chapter of the Native Plant Society for a hike to explore the newly constructed Manzanita Trail in the Miller Peninsula State Park on Thursday, December 14th. Since many plants will be dormant during this winter season, hikers will learn about and practice winter twig identification. Check the Olympic chapter of the Native Plant Society webpage for further information.
And lastly, do attend the lecture by Nature Now's guest this week, Curtis Deutsch, on Sunday afternoon, December 10th, at the Commons at Fort Warden. The title of the talk is Short of Breath, Marine Life in a Warming World. Nature Now listeners will learn more and be able to ask Dr. Deutsch follow-up questions. Check the Port Townsend Marine Science Center website for more information. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow, that's one word, naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is If I Were the Ocean, performed by Mark Mancina. Thank you.